right. I'm Edgar B. Herwick III, and you're listening to Boston Public Radio. Now, Shakespeare once asked, what's in a name? Well, for William Wadsworth Hodgkinson and Adolf Zukor, I would say quite a bit. In the early 1900s, they called their burgeoning film production and distribution company Paramount Pictures. Now, last week here on Boston Public Radio, we spoke with Peter Sokolowski, who's the editor-at-large at Merriam-Webster's. So I consulted his trusty dictionary to find out the exact definition of that word, Paramount. And it means, and I quote, superior to all others. Well, this year, Paramount Pictures celebrates their 100th anniversary, and this month, the Harvard Film Archive is celebrating the famed studio by screening selections from its considerable canon. So in the end, the question is their work superior to all others? Here to dig into that question are David Pendleton, who's the programmer at the Harvard Film Archive, and making his triumphant return to the studios here for the second time today, film critic Garen Daly. Thank you, gentlemen, both for being with me today.
My pleasure.
So, David, let me start with you. How did you get onto this? How did you get onto this idea of celebrating 100 years of Paramount Pictures with the Harvard Film Archive?
It worked out well with it's a part of our attempts to sort of bring a broad spectrum of film to Boston and to Cambridge. Typically what we do for much of the year is promote cinema that doesn't have a corporate backing, cinema that often doesn't even have distribution in the U.S. But in the summer, like so many other arts organizations, we like to do sometimes larger programs, sometimes more accessible programs. And we've had success doing large looks back at American cinema and Hollywood over the last couple of years, often doing complete retrospectives of filmmakers. This year, it seemed like a natural fit because of the fact that it was the 100th anniversary of the establishment of Paramount. It seemed like a time to step away from doing a director-based retrospective and do a studio-based retrospective to give people a sense of what American filmmaking was like during the studio era and what the Hollywood studios used to be capable of doing. And so that's really where it came from. And the idea then was to sort of present a spectrum of what Paramount did, mostly in the first, let's say, two-thirds of its history, two-thirds to three-quarters. The more recent stuff we figure people can discover on their own.
So when you say the studio system and what a studio is capable of, over the course of 100 years, it seems to me that Paramount Pictures probably has changed quite a bit. The film industry has changed immensely. I mean, when it started, it was the beginnings. It was a burgeoning industry. What is the story of Paramount? I can throw this out to both of you in short order. I mean, obviously, you can't go over 100 years, but generally, are there chunks of time that it breaks down into?
You could easily deconstruct it and say, there's the early period where they are working in Nickelodeons and they're slowly expanding and they are at the cutting edge of technology. Projection equipment was considered one of the technologies of the time. And then it went into a full-fledged studio system in the 20s and 30s where they had their own stars. One of the big things that came out of the 100th is the Vanity Fair did a current picture of 100 stars from Paramount, and it was all over the web. And then, you get into the post-World War II period with the Paramount Consent Decree, which is a major shifting of what goes on in the industry, the decline of the studios, the resurgence of the studios, the corporatization of the studios, and now we're into the digitization of the film industry. So Paramount encompasses all of that, and it's unusual that you have one corporate entity encompassing the entire history of a major industry. I think one of the more interesting stats was there's only been 8 heads of studio in 100 years at Paramount.
Right. Well, that's because Adolf Zukor was the head for many, many years. I mean, he lived to be 103, and he's really sort of one of the primary examples of a studio mogul. I mean, somebody who built a studio out of a passion for making films. I mean, yes, when he started, film was seen as an amusement. I think Zukor is one of the first people in this country to have an idea that film could be more than that. That's one reason. I mean, the company that he first founded was called Famous Players in Famous Plays, and it started as a distribution unit. Paramount dates itself to the date in 1912 when Zukor opened a French film in New York, which was unusual. There had already been, you know, some circulation of films internationally, but also it was a four-reel film, whereas American film at that point, under Edison and his trust, was more or less limited to one or two-reel films. So Zucker was interested in making film more of a theatrical experience. And so it's called Famous Players and Famous Plays because he had this idea of bringing accomplished performers in front of the movie, in front of moving picture cameras, and creating an experience for an audience to go and sit through that would be longer than the one or two reel films, which are often, you know, documented various sorts of fairground attractions or very simple comedies or very simple sort of special effects stories at that point.
Talking with David Pendleton, who's a programmer at the Harvard Film Archive, and also with us in the studio here is Garen Daly, film critic. And we're talking about Paramount's 100th anniversary and a celebration that's been going on at the Harvard Film Archive of films from that entire oeuvre of 100 years at Paramount. David, how do you put this together? Are you trying to tell the story of the studio through films? And if so, how do you comb through all these films and pick some?
I think of it as sort of a matrix in a way, that we're presenting a group of films, but we don't present them necessarily in strictly chronological order because there are certain people who are interested in the 1930s cinema and we don't want to have them have to pick from like one film out of six or seven in a weekend and not come to the rest of the series.
Right.
So it's not in strictly chronological order. Things are woven together. And so the idea is more that the more films that you come to, the more you get a sense of the ways in which the studio responded to what was happening around it socially and in terms of filmmaking in different ways. So if you've come to the whole series, you've seen responses to World War II, to the Depression, to Watergate, etc. And like I said, the idea is to enlarge people's expectations or ideas about what Hollywood filmmaking can be in an age where so much commercial filmmaking has become really driven by franchises, as they're called, and by the youth market.
Garen, this is something that you've in your time in the film world done. You've put festivals together. You've assembled. Like I think of it like making a great mixtape in a way, right? Like you're trying to tell a story in some way with other people's work. It's like curating maybe in a museum context on some level. What's the story as you look over what's happened at the film archive with this? What's the story that you are reading when you look over this selection of films?
Well, first of all, I think that it's great that the Harvard Film Archive is continuing the tradition of putting these kinds of festivals together. There was a time in Boston not too long ago, 20, 30 years ago, when there was literally 10 or 15 art houses that would put together a festival, whether it was the Paramount Festival or whether it was the Goldwyn Festival or whether it was a festival with a specific theme. But it was a way of marketing and growing your audience. And as these theaters have shuttered and are no longer around, and I'm talking about the Paris, the 733, the Brattle Square, the Harvard Square is now gone as well, the Janus, and my particular favorite, the Orson Welles Cinemas, these are all gone. So it's great that the Harvard Square or the Harvard Film Archive is able to continue this tradition. And one of the things that I noticed for it as a commercial booker, you try to create an arc. You try to create an arc that, you know, brings people in the beginning, maintains them in the middle, and then brings them for a wow finish. I think that David has the luxury of kind of like maybe exploring some new different angles. And we were talking about it in the green room. If it were me, I would have started off with the 1927 film Wings, which won the first Academy Award, which is a war film.
Right.
And because I would want, because as David's one of his last two films, is the In Harm's Way, which is another war film. And you can do a nice, wonderful compare and contrast of what it looked like in 1927 and what a John Wayne film In Harm's Way looked like in that period. So I think that it's different, but it's the same, and it's great, and I hope that people understand that this doesn't happen all the time,
yeah,
and they should really appreciate the effort that's being put on.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting to let's talk about some of the films, because we have some sound from someone, we'll get into that in a second, but just give me a sense of some of the films that Paramount has done over the years that people would know.
Mm-hmm. Well, for instance, they were the studio of Billy Wilder for many, many decades at the beginning of his career. And so, I mean, some of the more popular films that we've shown were, for instance, Double Indemnity, The Lost Weekend, Sunset Boulevard. But also, I mean, in the 1930s, they had a lot of major stars. They had Dietrich, and they had Gary Cooper. They had W.C. Fields as well, and Mae West. So, I mean, we showed things like I'm No Angel, and It's a Gift, these great sort of Fields, and Mae West vehicles. The other period that people I think will know about is the 1970s, when Robert Evans was the head of production, and Paramount was the studio that came out with Rosemary's Baby, with the first two Godfather films, with Chinatown, with Love Story, Serpico. And then even after that, I mean, Paramount was the distributor of, for instance, Days of Heaven, Terrence Malick's second film that really did a lot to put him on the map. And more recently, they're the studio of, for instance, the Indiana Jones pictures, the Star Trek pictures, a lot of the J.J. Abrams films, etc. They continue to be an important studio.
And let's not forget, in the 90s, Wayne's World, and I believe Wayne's World 2. Throwing that out there.
Okay. I missed that one.
Favorite in the Herwick household and among certain people in the WGBH newsroom as well.
But, you know, let me just run down a couple, just run quickly. Yeah. I may hit some of the films that David did. Airplane, Top Gun, Psycho, Adam's Family, There Will Be Blood, Titanic, Transformers, Up in the Air, Godfather, Friday the 13th, Hunt for Red October, Election, Crocodile Dundee, Catch 22, Beverly Hills Cop, Up in Smoke, Breakfast at Tiffany's, Forrest Gump, True Grit, The Warriors, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, Vertigo, Inconvenient Truth, Officer and a Gentleman, Days of Thunder, Gulliver's Travels, War of the Worlds, Sullivan's Travels, Preston Sturges. You know, I mean, their list of films.
Couple
is,
of good movies. Couple
there's
of
more
ones
than, more
that
than
were
just a couple.
Good.
I mean, there's a reason why they've been around for 100 years.
Yeah.
They have been able to maintain a certain quality and a certain amount of box office to make it worthwhile for people to go.
Can I just point out that we're showing Breakfast at Tiffany's?
I was going to say, yeah.
Breakfast at Tiffany's and The Warriors on Saturday.
So that's tomorrow.
Tomorrow evening.
And let's quickly, we're almost out of time, but I want to talk about another couple of movies that are still going to happen that people can go and see. One is the final film. I want to talk about the final film, which I find to be a very curious choice. And I want to just quickly talk about it. This is the live action Popeye from 1980. And this was a Robert Altman film. Here's just a little cut of this. Robin Williams playing the famed cartoon character Popeye.
You just duck?
I'll pay 25 cents docking tax.
What for?
Where's your sea craft?
There ain't no sea craft. There's me dinghy in it under the wharf.
You're near in town, right?
Call us a town, yeah.
Well, first of all, there's 17 cents new in town tax. Then there's 45 cents rowboat under the wharf tax and $1 leaving your junk lying around the wharf tax. So all together, you owe the Commodore $1.87.
Who's this Commodore?
That's the nature of a question. There's a little question tax.
So there you go. You hear definitely a sense of humor that's maybe hearkening back to a little bit of the time period when Popeye came out, which was the 1930s.
Yes. The screenplay for the film is by Jules Pfeiffer, the famed comic artist, who looked back to the original E.C. Seeger comic strips of the 1930s that were these sort of rather famously populist comic strips before Popeye became a cartoon character, thanks to the Fleischer brothers. The film is definitely an attempt to look back to the very beginnings of the Popeye myth. And in a way, the film, I think, finds Paramount in 1980 looking back to the 1930s, because Paramount was, in fact, the distributor for the Fleischer brothers cartoons in the 1930s, and it was the Fleischer brothers who made not just Betty Boop, but also the Popeye cartoons of the day. And so, in a way, it's Paramount coming full circle.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I like about, I mean, the film did not do very well at the box office.
Yeah.
Altman was probably not necessarily the right choice of director, But it was also, for me, a throwback to the vaudevillian times. There's lots of things going on in the background that Altman does, where he has great vaudevillian actors doing shticks, which I enjoy.
Very cool.
Yes. And Altman's films are often all about communities and the way that misfits either work together or don't to make a community. And so in some ways, I think that actually Popeye, you can totally pie Popeye into like the through line from, you know, MASH and McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Nashville, etc.
A lot of good stuff happening. Harvard Film Archive, one of the other things they're doing is on Saturday, September 1st, a series of pre-code films. This is before the censors got involved in the 30s, so that's another thing to check out. All the information for that is available on our website. That's wgbhnews.org. Guys, I could go for an hour with you here, but unfortunately we're out of time. Garen Daly, film critic, and David Pendleton, Harvard Film Archive programmer. Thank you both for being with me today.
Thank you.
Thank
All
you
right.
for having me.
Well, one last time, here we go. Callie Crossley, before the weekend comes, send us home.
Thanks, Edgar. Thanks so much for joining us for another edition of Boston Public Radio. The conversation continues 24 hours a day on our Facebook page. Tune in Monday for the latest political headlines and a critical look at the Bay State's new health care law. Right now, we have to say goodbye to our intern, Sloan Paiva. Sloan will miss your wit, wisdom, wisecracks, and hard work. I'm Callie Crossley. Boston Public Radio is a production of WGBH.